Simon Bishop, Head of History at Ullswater Community College.
Thank you. Please, can you tell me a little bit about yourself, your home background, parents and schooling?
My parents are working class. My mother might be put as lower middle class. Dad was a farmhand. He left, joined the army. So I've got quite a strict sort of background from that. About the age of 8, I was found coasting in primary school and was immediately picked up and put into boarding school within half a term. So I then received a very traditional education from that point onwards.
But you moved to grammar school at one point, did you?
Yeah, I had a choice between King's Canterbury and Cranbrook, which are both schools in Kent. One is a very high-flying private school, one is a state-maintained grammar school. I went for the grammar school one because when we looked around the private school, there was a young lad crying, so I didn't take it as a good sign. And there were girls at the Cranbrook, whereas I'd been at an all-boys prep school till then.
Right. Can you remember anything about the way you were taught history at school?
Yeah, it was mainly chalk and talk and dare I say it, dictation. In fact, nearly every lesson at prep school was you kept up with the master as he moved the overhead projector up another line.
Was that the same at grammar school as well?
At grammar school, the history teacher sat at the front of the room and talked, and you wrote down every word he said, and then there was a test every fortnight.
So, the sort of skills of just keeping up with the teacher in each case.
We did. I remember doing a week on source evaluation skills with the teacher, and he was just a question of, there's one paper on source skills, you'll be fine, do this. And he was actually right.
But there was no theory or attempts to teach
no,
you to
No, it was mainly dictation, learn and regurgitate.
Okay, so why then did you decide to become a history teacher?
I enjoy history and I enjoy working with young people, so that's sort of the main two reasons behind it. There was a third reason. I'd originally joined to go into the Navy and I'd actually injured my back, so I needed an alternative career, and that one just sort of developed, shall we say.
Did you do a history degree?
I started off doing an engineering degree and then converted across to finally do a history degree.
When you'd hurt your back?
Yeah.
Yeah. And where did you train?
I trained at Canterbury Christchurch.
And what sort of experience was that?
Very good, actually. The history PGC there was excellent.
What was excellent about it?
The amount of time that was given to you by the person who actually ran the course. Always there at the end of a phone, email, or even face-to-face visit. But it's just very professionally well-run course.
What was the balance in the course between the practical and the theoretical?
I personally feel there was too much theoretical. The practical side of it was enough. I had two main placements, but it would be nice to spend more time in school, but that might just be myself.
Mm. So the main thing you learnt was the practical side plus the support?
Mm. I think the actual theory of teaching at that stage in the career, it was good to have a grounding in it, but I think sometimes we went far too much into depth. It would be much nicer to actually get more hands-on experience in the classroom at that stage within the career.
And was there any specialist training in how to teach history as a subject?
Yeah, it was a history PGCE. And the person who mentored me at my first placement, he was an advanced skills teacher. So I had a lot of input from people on that.
So you learnt quite a lot from that year?
Yeah, and most of it I learnt from actually being in the school placements rather than being out of placement in the college.
But when you were in the placement, you were supported?
Oh, very much so, yeah.
In what way? What was the support given?
Just time. And I think, as teachers, having that time to give to someone you're trying to train is actually, it's difficult to give sometimes, so I was very appreciative of it.
Did they give you materials?
Yes and no. I mean, teaching's a busy job. Sometimes you're encouraged to make your own materials, sometimes you're encouraged to share. I think it depends where you are in terms of development.
Okay. How did you adapt your teaching to meet the needs of less able children?
I think this is actually where my politics actually changed on first experience, because having gone to quite prep school and then grammar school, you suddenly realise that actually you're not mixing with a good 80-90% of the population, and it was a real shock just to see how limited some children were and whether what they were being taught was actually right or not. So it was a massive change for me. So I changed the way I spoke, I changed how I present words, everything that we've been told to do, we did. But it was a big shock to the system.
So were you teaching placements in secondary modern schools in Kent?
Yeah, one was a bit like here actually, big, but had almost the full ability range. and one was a lot smaller and a lot lower down the ability range.
How did you adapt the sort of topics and materials that you were teaching?
I think it's just actually building up a good rapport with the students. I do think students will mainly go to whatever they're being taught. I think, especially with history, we're very lucky. They do tend to find a genuine interest in most subjects. And as a teacher, most topics have one little bit of detail that appeal to most students. So we're very lucky there. But adapting, I mean, the rapport, I did a sort of quite a bit of youth work when I was younger and also did some sort of DJing and stuff. So kind of at I know how to interact with certain aspects of society that some people might find difficult, and found it very interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, meeting kids who you might have met at a party, and actually, you know, a couple of years earlier, before you started teaching, in the middle of a field somewhere, you know, when they're actually in a classroom situation, thinking, my word, you know, this kid does actually enjoy their history. But I think it's the nature of the subject. I think less able children love it more than many other subjects because there's something for everyone. However, there is the issue of literacy.
Well, we'll pick up that later on, because that's an interesting comment to make. I wondered if you'd used your naval interests as a way into getting a connection with children, because I noticed you worked in Chatham and
Chatham, yeah, so. I mean, Chatham, that we were about second generation unemployment there from the closure of the dockyard in the early 80s, so you'd expect there to be sort of a seafaring people, but no, I never really met anyone. It tended to be mostly people who knew someone who had worked in the dockyard rather than actually on the ships.
Thinking back to that first year in the classroom, what kind of history did you most enjoy teaching?
I quite enjoyed teaching the medieval history, because I'd never really come across it before in detail until I started my PGCE. So it was really nice to actually do the background reading on. I really did enjoy that for the Year 7s. I also quite enjoyed teaching the Holocaust as well. That was quite interesting.
That was Year 9?
Yeah, to a bottom group. And that was interesting, because there's quite a lot of racial prejudice in Medway, where I used to teach. So it was interesting getting that across to the children.
And how did you tackle it?
Just honestly. You know, you move from the horrible comment that you hear of why are those people here to actually a pretty, you know, in-depth discussion on the rights and wrongs of genocide. So as long as you do it in stages, gradually, and use examples that the students have come across, you tend to be all right.
Were these topics that you yourself had studied at degree level, or were you coming to them new?
No, I think that's it's not an issue in history teaching, but it's almost a joy, really. You come across so many new areas that you never met on your degree. There's no way on your degree course you can be taught everything that you're ever going to use in your history teaching career. So I just found it much more enjoyable. I mean, my actual degree, the bulk of it, is in Middle East history and naval Napoleonic warfare, which there isn't that much in the classroom, I'm afraid. So
you had to put a lot of preparation time in there.
Yeah, I love reading history, so, you know. If I didn't have a job doing history teaching, I'd still read history books.
And what about the least enjoyable topics that you had to teach?
That is a difficult question, because I don't really not enjoy any topics, but maybe the Chartists.
Why didn't you like the Chartists?
I don't know. It's just something I've always had a thing. Although I do quite enjoy teaching them, but yeah, you know, if I had to pick one, probably political developments during the 1800s. Well, that's important. Yeah, the kids I teach would enjoy it. But yeah, I wouldn't personally go out and buy myself an extra book on the Chartists.
Right.
Very important as they are, but not my cup of tea. No ships.
What, in your view, really switches children on to learning history?
A teacher who's engaged with the subject. And that's very important. They have to have somebody at the front of the room who's got a passion for the subject. Then they develop a passion for it. Because then I think if you've got a passion for something, they will take a little bit of that on board. So again, you can almost teach any topic as long as you're passionate about it.
And how do you convey that passion?
Humour, pace, change of language.
So a typical lesson, would you start by engaging them in some sort of issue that you yourself are interested in?
Not necessarily, but that's one way in. There's many ways to get the children engaged, whether it's through a visual source or a written source, or just a question, you know, from their own general knowledge or an example. And that example can either be from history or on today, you know, from today in terms of comparison. So there's so much. I mean, we're very lucky. We really are there, but there is so much that you can choose from history to get children engaged with. But you've got to have a passion for it.
How did your ideas about how to teach history change over time? Because you've now been teaching about 10 years.
Yeah, it's about that, isn't it? I think over time, what I've seen is, whatever they say in the press, I think there's definitely still a huge amount of content that children have to get through. I do worry there's the way history has reinvented itself into a skills-based subject. I do worry that perhaps we've lost a little bit of the way of what historians really do, and it does worry me that perhaps our GCSE students will be very good assistants to historians. You know, they'll be able to analyse the sources, but again, the content and knowledge has been subtracted a little bit over the years, but it's still a huge amount, which means that my sort of views on teaching has been, how would we get that content across? I think the skills is not easy to develop, but it can be developed almost any child, but the knowledge compared to other subjects, it's changing ways to get children to remember the actual content.
That must have been quite a challenge in the secondary modern schools.
Yes.
How did you deal with the fact that children in those lower ability levels often find it very difficult to retain large amounts of content?
The whole school used whole school approaches, and that's what made it very successful like that. So students were brought up from year seven to complete lots of homework, and there were many tests, and each year there was an actual test, and the head wanted a lot of these tests aimed at knowledge retention.
So what have been the main influences on your own approach to teaching over the years? Did it come from outside or from the school itself?
Yeah, one of the people I worked with in the South was a guy called Darren Richardson, who's head of history at the Westland School. And he and I have a similar philosophy on sort of the balance of skills and content, but he's a very natural teacher, very annoying, but very, very good, and we have a very similar approach in the classroom, and we work very well together. We have done some team teaching, but he's someone I really do quite admire in terms of the way he approaches his teaching.
Was he a colleague in a neighbouring school?
He actually took over my job when I left in my first school, and then he actually ended up living with me for a bit, so I know him quite well, yeah.
Have you found the national curriculum helpful or restrictive in your teaching of history?
I think it's useful in telling you what as a nation, if the government is chosen by the nation, what as a nation, what we want our children to learn. There's a lot of stuff in the press about the national curriculum being restrictive or too prescriptive or too loose, and actually I found that however you interpret the national curriculum, you probably end up teaching what you want to teach anyway. So I've never really found it a big issue, the national curriculum. It's never too prescriptive on what you have to teach. However, that has changed recently.
What would you say about the recent changes?
Well, the political, and I think that's the issue we have in education today, is there's far too much politics in it. In terms of the changes are what politicians want the changes to be, such as the Holocaust must be taught. But I wouldn't know a school that wouldn't not teach the Holocaust, but they might teach it in their RE lessons, but now no, it must be in the history lessons as well. And it seems very patronising to history teachers to actually make that very prescriptive, and I think it comes from rumours that are in the press that children aren't learning about this or that anymore. They're all being taught socialist history, especially if you read the Daily Mail, whatever that is. I think there's far too much made out of the national curriculum. As far as what we're concerned as a department, you've got years 7, 8 and 9 to give the kids a pretty good grounding in the basics of history from 1066 to the 20th century.
So you're talking about British history there?
Well, yeah. I mean, that was the other thing that the press apparently said, that no longer was British history being taught. And I've never come across a school which at some point doesn't teach British history. And even in schools where I talk, it's got a high ethnic minority percentage, yeah, you adapt topics to suit your learners. But at the same time, I think, you know, the press has completely overplayed what is happening in the classroom. And to be honest, there's probably not much choice between the topics or difference between the topics that students would study now and what they studied, say, 50 years ago. I really think that.
That might be partly due to the national curriculum itself.
Yeah, but then the national curriculum was only introduced in the 80s. I do think that the national curriculums for history that have been introduced, they're quite flexible. You can work around them if there's something you totally disagree with.
You mentioned in your survey form that the national curriculum now, there's more emphasis on overviews through themes.
Mm.
Do you think that's helpful for students?
Yes and no. I think it's helpful for them to see how subjects link together, but I think it's very unhelpful to take discrete subjects out of the particular path they're going down. For instance, in history, I much prefer students to follow a chronological approach to key stage three. But if you're following themes, and the themes have to be taught across the school, then that actually could upset the chronological approach history.
Is that happening in this school?
No, it's not. No, we've got a 3-year chronological key stage three. There were discussions to change it, but that hasn't happened.
And is that something that you feel you've influenced yourself?
I don't know. I do feel, though, that 3 years is a short time, so 2 years must be even shorter.
Yes.
And I do think a chronological approach allows students to actually hang events on that timeline. And if they've learned them in that order, they probably realise that they've happened in that order. Otherwise, you just give kids sort of they know something about evacuation, they know something about the trenches, but they might not be able to chronologically place the two next to each other.
How do you actually convey chronology? Is it implicit in the fact that you're teaching a series of events which have different date labels attached to them?
We do timelines and overviews, and we do in-depth studies, and we try and show them where they are in the sense of history. But I think it's one of the benefits of approaching it in a chronological way that the children themselves actually do understand. But there are times that you do need to break away. For instance, we're doing the slave trade at the moment in year eight, but after half term we will move into civil rights in the USA. So there's actually a break from the chronology, but that's because this is a very interesting topic that has to be finished for it to make sense.
And then after you've done civil rights in the USA, do you return?
We then return, yeah. Return then be beginning of year nine, which would be the start of the First World War. So there is a jump there, but it's a necessary one.
So you're actually missing out the 19th century,
aren't you? We do that in year eight. We do that just before the slave trade. The two run parallel. It is very difficult to, if you go down a chronological approach, it's very difficult to have it purely chronological. You do have to adapt it. But the children do know when things happened, relative to each other.
You've also mentioned that in Key Stage 3 you've got an increased isolation of history skills. That's at GCSE.
Yeah, I do think at GCSE, I think history is beginning to rear its head in terms of the amount of literacy needed to get a very good grade in it. I think it stands head and shoulders above many other subjects in terms of the amount of literacy we expect from students.
Is that a recent phenomenon?
No, I don't think it is. I think, if anything, the phenomenon it has been over the last few years is that the literacy requirement of other subjects has gone down, whereas history is still the same. I mean, the questions on the exam papers are not differentiated. You need a high standard of literacy just to be able to understand what the question is asking you, let alone answer it.
Yeah. Was that something that was a real problem when you were in Kent?
Yeah, I mean, we had to teach real definitions of what each type of question meant. It was difficult for the students to understand, especially the lower attaining students. And a lot of it, I mean, we've just done a lot of work here, is about steering students to the right qualification. And history has a gap, as far as I believe. You've got GCSE and you've got entry level certificate, but you've got nothing in between. So yeah, a student could do GCSE history, get a D or an E or an F. But carrying that through into the workplace, that kind of grade, does have connotations.
You do an entry-level history qualification?
Yeah, we do here. We've got something called EMOMP block, which is a profound learning, strategic profound learning difficulties centre. Get that wrong, right?
And they do history?
Yeah. So we have students with profound learning difficulties, which range from mild Down syndrome all the way down to, I don't know the technical words, but there are students in wheelchairs who can't speak and hear. So we teach this entry level, and they do well. And it's quite nice. It's more finding out about history. But there does need to be something in between, in my opinion, the entry level and the GCSE.
So what would you think there should be?
Well, there was talk of a diploma in humanities, and that's apparently going to get very cancelled. And that would have been ideal.
For the lower attaining pupils?
Just, well, or for pupils who want to do more hands-on history, especially they're going into the sort of the heritage sector afterwards, or just enjoy history. You know, they just want to know what happened, maybe not analyse the utility or reliability of a source, you know, in comparison to other sources. That's not the history they want to do. But, yeah, we have good take-up at GCSE, so...
What percentage of the Key Stage 3 year groups are going on to GCSE history?
I could work that one out of my head. That's about 270. Then we have 50 students. It's between 50 and 60 students a year out of a cohort of about 240. So, can't do the maths on that one. The fifth, is that?
About that,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it's about 25%. I mean, we do well on that. And so we run three groups at GCSE.
So the students who don't continue with history, are a proportion doing geography or another humanities, or are they doing other courses?
Some are. I mean, here they get very, very flexible choice. So it is possible to have the students get the subjects they want. I think our dilemma is we do have students who'd like to do history, but say it's too difficult for them. And I think they'd know if they did it, they wouldn't get a C or above. And unfortunately, as I said before, that does have certain prejudices as which attach to it. Fortunately.
So what do they do instead?
Well, they won't do history, and that's my issue with the current range of examinations.
But they do other examinations?
Yeah, they would do. So they'd be doing diplomas or BTECs or MVQs. They might be doing some GCSEs, maths and some of the science ones. But I think here we just swap to the BTEC science for many students who perhaps wouldn't be doing history GCSE. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it is. I think it's a need that does need to get looked at some point.
I wanted to ask you about the balance between skills of working with evidence and acquiring knowledge. From what you were saying, you think there has been a little bit too much of a tilt towards the skills agenda.
Yeah.
But you presumably do still teach.
Oh, yeah, very much skills. So. You have to, yeah. It's probably a good 50-50 mix, to be honest. You know, if we're dealing with knowledge, then we're dealing with skills at the same time. But I do worry that... students are leaving without that necessary background of knowledge that will help them in their own life. I mean, here we do it well, I'd like to think.
Is it something that's addressed at A level?
In what way?
That there's more content, if you like, and less skills.
Yes, yeah, and with the new A level, we think there's actually a lot more content. But that again is a huge jump for the students who... If they've been doing history, yes, they're quite used to it, but it's still a big jump for them. But we have the occasional student who's come in at A level, hasn't done GCSE history, and it's like, wow, I have to know a lot. Like, yes.
Do you think history teaching in the sixth form's changed much over your career?
No, not really. But maybe I've just had quite a short career so far. No, I think it's actually stayed relatively the same. If anything, there's more emphasis now on more active learning at sixth form than perhaps what there was, but it was still there when I started teaching.
And what would be the typical approach in a sixth form lesson?
Again, it depends on your topic. Do you want to get knowledge across them or skills? So if it's knowledge, it might be spider diagrams, ranking the skills. The content, ranking the content, get an idea of significance and reasons for that. Or it might be pair work in terms of source evaluation. It could be silent essays and then going through them afterwards with each other, trying to work out how they could be improved. So, a variety of tasks.
And what topics do you do for A-level?
For A-level at the moment we do the experience of warfare, which looks at the Boer, the Crimea and the First World War. And that's a skills-based unit. We also do a unit on the Norman Conquest, and in year 13 we do the English Civil Wars and a historical inquiry unit.
So it's quite heavily based on study of war.
Yeah, it's mainly around conflict and change, and unfortunately the choice really went around the British history unit. There wasn't much offered by the exam board that we chose. So it's one of the issues I do have for the new history A-level courses is I think there was an opportunity for a very wide selection of topics, and there has been, but in some places it could have been wider.
Do you find that girls choose that less than boys?
No. In fact, when I did some analysis on it for my last CEF, it seems to be that a weak spot is not boys or girls, because each year it fluctuates from one to the other. So somewhere along the line, we're doing something right. There's no statistical variation either way.
You mentioned in your survey form that there's a reluctance of students at sixth form level to do necessary reading. Yeah. And you also mentioned preparation for seminar-style lessons.
Yeah, it's... And this is something I've noticed since starting teaching. There's more reluctance of students to work outside the lessons unless you have specifically set a task. And even if you specifically set reading, a lot of students find it very difficult to accept that is a valid task.
Why do they not think it's a valid task?
And I think the problem is because they don't do the level of reading we expect in any other subject. I really do feel that. I imagine if they did English, they'd read a lot. But in a lot of the subjects, there is just one textbook. We expect them to read widely.
So you don't just use the exam board textbook?
No. We order in any text the students need. We provide them with photocopies of various selections of authors. They definitely get a lot, which might put some of them off, perhaps.
In fact, there is quite a lot about textbooks in your survey form, and you refer to the fact that you're relying on textbooks more because of the cost of photocopying.
Yeah, this is actually something that's been addressed recently, which is great news. I've been given some extra money to buy some textbooks. But it is an issue, and every time the government changes, whichever government's in power, changes the national curriculum or the GCSEs or the A-levels, there's a host of money being spent by schools on the new courses. So it's quite naughty, actually. There's a massive industry in making textbooks. But I do think it's very naughty in the fact that every time there's this, schools need to buy, and where does the money come from?
Now, you've said that this textbook actually is a very important element in your teaching. What do you look for in a textbook?
Good range, in the history anyway, good range of historical sources, colourful, well presented, not too busy on the page. And I'm always amazed at the textbooks you do see that, you know, you think, wow, I can't concentrate on that, so how on earth is a 12-year-old going to? But we're looking at getting some new ones, as I say, because we've got some funding come in now, and that should be quite good.
What will you look for in terms of the language level and reading content?
And this is it, because of the limited funding, and I have to say I'm quite happy for the funding I'm getting, you know. We've got to choose something that attacks the literacy levels of most students. So at the top end, we're probably still going to have to find extra, and at the bottom end, there still have to be more support. So no textbook's an answer. But it's something we'll look for, would be the textbook that A, can do good for most of our students, but B, also with the interactive whiteboards, hopefully we'll have a package that will go alongside it with that, and also worksheets for the teachers so they don't have to end up preparing their own all the time.
So do you work as a team preparing your worksheets?
Yeah, yeah.
That brings us quite neatly onto the use of the technology and the electronic whiteboard. Is that an integral part of your teaching now?
I'd say now it's perhaps not, but that's because we're waiting refurbishment of parts and bulbs and things, which cost a lot of money. I think you go around a lot of open days, evenings with schools, and they're very keen to show off the electronic whiteboards, but it's a lot of money, each package, and then you have to maintain it. Maintaining the whiteboards is, I think, proving difficult for schools. I think they are very, very useful. But if I had to choose, I'd have a projector rather than, you know, none, or a projector and a whiteboard.
Well, would you go for the projector?
It does everything you need. There are new interactive whiteboards that you can use dry white pens on. These ones you can't. That's why I just have the projector.
But what do you use the projector for?
Oh, I use the projector for any sources we're looking at as a class. If necessary, going on the internet. I will use packages that we've bought. There's one called Boardworks that we use.
Do you use video as well?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's great for that.
That's what I was expecting you to say.
Yeah, it is great for that, though. And it does, you know, it's lovely to have. It beats the TV in the corner of the room. Which you still have in a couple of classrooms here. But it is something great, but it is money to maintain it, and that's the issue.
How do you feel the students react to the use of technology in history?
I think they quite like seeing things up on the board, but I think it's across the entire subject range. They think, oh, it's going to be more exciting than usual, and that's got to be good.
Do they use computers a lot in their work in history?
Yes and no. Where we can, which is the no bit, we do try and get the computer rooms, but there's not many and they're always booked. They're normally pre-booked for certain departments, use them for certain parts. But the students use IT widely in their own work. And it's something that very impresses me about young people today. It's very natural to them. Although perhaps they haven't had their RSA input yet on how they quite type. But it is good to see.
Just on the theme of British national identity, do you think that it is an important feature of your teaching that you're conveying a sense of national identity?
See, again, it's a political football, this national identity, and it's all very well to go, right, okay, I'm British and I'm going to teach a British curriculum, but then when you actually do trace your family history, you find out, well, actually, I'm not British, or I was as British as I thought, you know, and the same with the kids as well. So the national identity is the identity of the nation at a particular point in time. So I do worry that some politicians, some people aren't politicians, hark back to a different era when there will be a different national identity. And you've got a lag between, I think, what the young of this country think is the national identity and what the older generation think is the national identity of the country.
What impression do you gain of, you know, what the young people do think national identity is about?
I think they're very, very proud of their country, and I think they're very proud of Britain for the fact it is actually a very free place to live. And when I do speak to children, I think they do appreciate the fact that they do live here in comparison to other countries. Whatever we see on the news about, especially when I even used to teach violence in London and urban areas, I do think most of the students that I've come across are very proud actually to be in Britain. And it's not a question of I'm British and some sort of nationalistic, but they're just pleased to be in a country where they're valued.
Some of the themes that you will pick up when you're teaching the topics like the Civil War, the struggle for freedom and rights. Do you emphasise the heritage in that? You know that.
Yeah, very very much so. I mean, I'm very democratic at heart, so I try not to be too biased in my teaching, but I do bring it through. Yeah, and they are beginning to realise, and the general election is giving a little bit of interest there to the students, and they're beginning to work out how we've arrived now at what we see today in the news with the general election going on from the past.
Does the history department contribute to the citizenship curriculum in the school?
No, I think contribute would be the wrong word. We complement it. We sort of teach the history of it, whereas citizenship do more than mechanics. But some of the more technical language we, strangely enough, tend to use rather than citizenship. That's because it's the way it's been developed through time.
Now, we've already mentioned the Holocaust and the slave trade, and you've said that you feel a little bit uncomfortable about the government mandating those. One of the reasons, obviously, is this issue about history having a moral dimension.
Yeah.
I mean, do you agree with that, that it has a duty to teach people to be decent?
Well, I don't know where it's got a duty to teach people to be decent, but there's definitely a duty to teach people the facts that allow them to arrive at what is decency, because otherwise you're putting your own moral agenda on young people rather than allowing them to draw their own judgments. And, you know, by making it mandatory for history to have to teach the Holocaust, why don't they just make it mandatory for the Holocaust to be taught? And then you'd have more range of where that would be. But again, that's someone's particular viewpoint of social identity. Yes, we could teach the Holocaust of the Second World War, we could always teach with the Rwandan genocide, or we could teach the Armenian genocide. And really what most teachers do is they teach the Holocaust because it's the one that children know most about, and then they might bring in other genocides to sort of compare and contrast to. So I don't think it needs to be made mandatory, because I think most teachers teach it anyway. And if you weren't teaching it, there'd probably be a pretty good reason why you weren't.
Do you think exams in history have changed for the better since you started teaching?
No, I think they've been, the latest set of exams we're very unhappy with. I think they were rushed in, and they're going to take a few years to sort themselves out, as happened with the curriculum 2000. I think that's just when I was starting to teach that. But again, you know, you're going to have 2-3 years of rough riding before the exam questions are standard and settled down, the mark scheme settled down, and teachers are happy with the content.
You mean the GCSE?
GCSE and the A level, actually. Yeah. So at the moment, I don't think the questions have really changed that much. Is history harder or easier? I think it's about the same, to be honest. It's always a hard subject because of the content and the literacy.
discussed technology. I wanted to ask you about local history, whether you do any local history here.
We look at Bryn Castle, which might just sound like we look at a castle, but it's quite a major castle to do with the Anglo-Scottish Wars, and also Reavers, very big in this area. But there's less time, or seems to be, for local history.
You don't do trips now?
No, we do try. We do one up to New Lanark, which is very, very good, and across to Beamish. The students like going there.
Which year do you use that?
Year 8. Beamish has got lots of hands-on exhibits. And the students really do enjoy that. Yeah. It's a shame, really, that there's not more opportunity. But we've got a no more than 3 teachers out rule, and together with sort of health and safety and the amount of funding, students wanting to be in lessons, pressures from everywhere, there's definitely less trips going ahead. Although we do want to maybe try and get something going for America in the future, but we'll see how that goes.
Recent trends in the school curriculum seem to be squeezing the time available for history. How highly rated is history in your school?
We seem to be rated reasonably well. I know I've got other colleagues having to fight not to be made into a humanities department. We're very lucky, it's respected well in the school. Students like it, parents like it. In terms of timetable time, we were recently going to redo our timetable for September, and that probably will give us slightly more time. So in other words, we won't really lose out. We're very lucky. There was one proposal where we would have lost out, and then I wouldn't have been too happy, where students would have only been receiving one history lesson a fortnight.
So what's the current allocation?
The current allocation is 250 minutes a week, and that will go down at Key Stage 3 to 350-minute lessons a week, which I can live with. Sorry, 350-minute lessons a fortnight. There we go.
That's better.
Yeah, that makes sense. Which I can live with. I've taught that before, and it is doable. But any less than that, it suddenly becomes very difficult to cover the content.
And what do you get at GCSE level?
GCSE, it's 350-minute lessons
a week.
Yeah, and that will be maintained, that allocation.
And A-level?
An A-level, it's 550-minute lessons a week. So not too bad.
I think the final question is just a nice one. If you could choose any historical topic to teach, what would it be and what age group?
It would be Napoleonic naval warfare to year 8.
Do you actually teach them that now?
No.
but it's a passion of your own.
Yeah, they'd enjoy it.
Do you stick it in just a little bit?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, when you get to that period.
I don't think they'd delight me if I taught a whole year on it, which I quite happily do. Then we could have a special step study on the American heavy frigates of the 1812 war. Yeah. This is where historians get a bad name for themselves.
Thank you very much, Simon.
Thank you.